Okay, we're going to be here on the top of Lamed Hey Lamed Aleph, about 10 lines down. The Gemara here is discussing the Mishnah. What exactly is the case in the Mishnah of Nitano Bamigdal? He placed it in this cupboard, then he loses the key, and he's unable to access it. The Tanakhama says it's fine, and Rabbi Eliezer says that it's problematic. So yesterday we had the first answer, the first attempt to answer, and that was Rav and Shmuel. Rav and Shmuel, Damar Tavai, Wachab Migdal Shel Leveni Maskinan. We're dealing with this brick type of tower or cupboard that's put together here. And the reason that you're allowed to access it is because we are following the Shita of Rabbi Meir. It's a case where the bricks are not cemented together. They're loosely fitted together. And that's why you're allowed to break into it on Yom Tov, because of Simchat Yom Tov. Today we're going to discuss an alternative answer, and that is, 10 lines down, Rabba V'Rav Yosef. It's a very interesting sugyo, because we'll have the three times of Amoraim speak, and each time they speak, it's the two Amoraim who are Baal Plugtot, and they agree. Here we have Rav and Shmuel. Before I said Rav and Shmuel, Damrei Tavayo. Here we have Rabba and Rav Yosef. We usually argue with Damrei Tarvayo, and later on we're going to have a Bayan Ravo with Damrei Tarvayo. It's just an interesting layout, and it's sugi, you don't usually see that. So now Rabba v'Rav Yosef, Damrei Tarvayo, Rabba and Rav Yosef both believe that the Mishnah is talking about Hocha, but Migdal shall eat askinan. As opposed to Rabba and Shmuel said that it was a Migdal shall Evan or Levenim, over here we're talking about a Migdal shall eat, a wooden cupboard. Now we have to explain the two positions in the Mishnah, Tanakhama and Rabbi Eliezer. The Mar Savar Klihu. One of them believes it's a Kli, ve'in binyan iklilim, ve'in stira bikilim. That's obviously the Tanakhama. Tanakhama believes we're talking about a utensil here, and therefore there's no binyan, no building, and no stira, no destruction or dismantling when it comes to kelim. So even though the Eruv is locked up inside of this, you can break it open without any problem. Umar Savar Olahu. On the other hand, Rabbi Eliezer believes that it's actually more of a permanent fixture. It's a larger item. And if it's classified as a building, per se, then there would be binyan and stira, and the stira would be problematic. On Shabbat, you wouldn't be able to break into it. It's similar to another machloket tanaim that we've seen. It's not. Hekish agave shida teva umigdal. Have a zav. Goes ahead and pounds on top of a shida teva umigdal. A box, a chest, covered, tmeim. Then they are tmei. Rabbi Nechemia, v'Rabbi Shimon, mitaharim. They say that it is tahor. Now the case, which the Gemara is going to discuss in 1 second here, is that the Zav, when he pounds on it, obviously didn't come into direct contact with it. It came into direct contact with the item would be tmei, because of tumat maga. A Zav who touches the item conveys the tumat to that item. So it obviously couldn't be a case of direct contact. Rashi suggests here that he's wearing a glove, or there's something on his arm, or he's doing it through an extension. He's using a beam or something else to hit the item with. But there's something between him and the item, so there's not direct contact with the item. So then he hits the item, and we're saying, machloket, is it tamei or tahor? My love, v'haka miflegei. This is what the argument revolves around. Mar savar klihu. The Tanakhama thinks that it is a kli. Mar savar oho. And the Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Nechemia think that it is a oh well, that's a building. The difference being that a zav can convey tuma through movement or hasata, the movement of an item or the causing an item to leave the ground. So we would think, or the havamina here is that is only true when it is a keli, only when it is a utensil. When it's a utensil, it's an item that's meant to be moved, and if he causes movement of the item, then it would become tame. On the other hand, if it's an ohel, if it's supposedly a permanent structure, and it's affixed to the ground. I mean, here it wouldn't be affixed to the ground, but permanent structures generally are affixed to the ground. But if it's classified as an ohel, then moving it wouldn't have this impact. That's the havamina of the Gemara here. And therefore, we have a machloket that reflects the similar machloket that we have in our Mishnah here. You have an item, like a migdal, and so too in this Mishnah from Zavin, you have a migdal, and the question is, what's the status of this migdal? Is this migdal classified as a keli, or is this migdal classified as an ohel? Is this a utensil, or is this a building? The same question that supposedly is in our Mishnah is being debated in this Mishnah in Zavin. Does that really make sense, what you're saying? V'atanya. Don't we have a brayta? Ohel v'niseit tamei. Kli v'enu niseit tahor. So the first thing is, your distinction that you're drawing here is not absolute. And you could probably sense that from the difficulty in expressing it before, why should it make a difference if it's a keli or an ohel? The keli or the ohel are really not the determining factor here. The determining factor in terms of conveying tumah for the zav is movement. So if you have a large kli that doesn't move, and he hits it and it doesn't move, then it's not going to be tameh. If you have a small ohel, and he hits it and it moves, it's going to be tameh. It's not determined by whether it's a keli or an ohel, it's simply determined by whether it moves. So if he moves it, it's tameh. If doesn't move it, it's not tameh. And that's the first thing we bring here, this braita. If he carries it, it's obviously tameh, because that's tumat masa. Here we're talking about tumat hesed. Tumat hesed is conveyed by the causing of the other item to shake or to move. And here the Gemara thinks at least that it has to leave the ground. So his power, when he smashed it or slammed something down on it, the item jumped off the ground a little bit. And jumping off the ground, that's called hesed, that's called the movement of that item. So here you have a braita that is explicit and says that the difference is not about ohel and kli, it's about movement and non-movement. And so it would not matter whether it was a kli or an ohel. That's number one. V'ktani seifa, in addition to that, the latter half, we quoted before a Mishnah, the Mishnah does not have this latter half, but the Tosefka, which has an identical Mishnah in Zavin, there has this last piece to it, which is v'mhayu nisotim tmeim. If they are moved, then they are tmeim. Zaklal. Here is the principle that's laid out. Niseit machmat kocho tamei. If they moved because of his force, then it's tamei. The item's tamei. Machmat re'ada. If it moved because of the reverberation, then tahor. So the difference being, if he whacks the item and then the item jumps, that's called hasata, and it would become tamei. On the other hand, if he smashes the ground next to it and it causes the item to jump, that would not be called hasata, because that's what we call koach kocho. It's a derivative of his power. So when he directly hits it and that causes a movement of the item, that's called hasata, that's kocho. That's his strength doing it, that's tamei. If he hits something else that then reverberates and then causes the thing to jump, then that's not called kocho, that's not called direct hasata by him, and it would not become tamei. So that's the principle being laid out here. So now, based on this, you have the braita plus the seifa of this item that says that the only thing that matters is hasata. Is it moved or not moved? There's nothing to do with the distinction between ohel and kli. So based on that, you cannot suggest that the machloket in that Mishnah is between ohel and kli. And if that's true, in our Mishnah as well, the migdal, you would not assume that this migdal has a possibility of being a kli or an ohel. Simply, it's one of those two categories. You have to pick whichever it is, depending on what the structure is. But nobody's arguing about the nature of a migdal, that one person would say it's an ohel and one person would say it's a keli. So, Ela Amara Abaye. Abaye says, what you must have to say is, to Kule Alma, everybody agrees, Hesed Machmat Kochol Tameh. That movement, because of his direct hit, or his direct strength, is Tameh. Machmat Re'ada, if it's because of reverberation, Tahor. That, everybody agrees to. There, we can line up the ducks, and we know exactly what everybody would, what their position would be. V'hacha. So then, what is the Machloket in that Mishnah in Zavin? Bira'ada, Machmat Kocho Askinan. Talking about reverberation from his strength. Well, all reverberations are from his strength. So then what happened here is that he hit the item directly, but the item did not jump off the ground. So he hits the item directly, but the item doesn't leave the ground. For in order to be hasata, we need the item to jump off the ground or to move. So instead of the item moving, what ends up happening when he hit it is that it shook. It reverberated itself. The item itself reverberated. So the question is that classified as hasata or not? Is that enough of a movement to be classified as hasata? We know that if he hits the item and it jumps off the ground, that's hasata. If it moves or gives a bounce, then that's hasata. We know that if he hits the ground and it bounces, there's no impact. That's not hasata, that's re'ada. Question is, if when he hits it, it doesn't jump out, but it reverberates, it shakes, is that called hasata? Is that sufficient? Or does hasata require you to have the item leave the ground? And so that's a machloket in that Mishnah in Zavin as to what is the status of that type of thing, which is a baradam machmat kochoskina, bahaka miflege, the marsavri avi hesed. The Tanakhama obviously believes that's hesed, and that's why he says it's tamei the item. Marsavri lo avi hesed. And Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Nechemiah believe that that is not called hesed, and therefore it's not tamei. But once you've added that, umatznitan, but my mukminan. Well, then what are you going to do with our Mishnah over here? We tried to establish that the machloket in our Mishnah by Migdal is to whether it's a kli or an ohel. Now, we connected it to a machloket in Migdal in Zavin. Umar or Abaye just showed you that that's just not the case. That Mishnah in Zavin doesn't see that as being the pivot point, as ohel and kli being the difference there. It's not a machloket as to what the status of a Migdal is, and therefore it would be less likely that that's the case here as well. That Migdal, that somebody's arguing about what the status of the Migdal is. The Migdal is either an ohel or a keli, depending on the situation, but it's unlikely that that's the machloket in our Mishnah. And if that's the case, then what are they arguing about? So again, we had before Rav and Shmuel's suggestion. We just had Rav and Rav Yosef's suggestion, which we dismissed, or Abaye dismissed. And then we have Abaye v'Rava, Adam Rei Tarvayu. Abaye and Rava both agree that this is the case here. V'men o v'katir b'mitna askinan. Still in a case where the cabinet is locked, v'katir b'mitna, and it's tied with a rope. The locking mechanism is not a key, like we were supposing before, rather a rope that's tied around it. They have a rope that's knotted there. Uvay sakina the mifsike. And he needs a knife to cut it open. In order to get access to this, he's basically going to have to cut the rope. We'll call it destroy the rope or destroy the lock in order to gain access to this cabinet, to this cupboard. So Tanakama sever like Rabbi Yossi. Tanakama believes like Rabbi Yossi. Damar kol kelim nitalim b'Shabbat. You're allowed to carry any keli, any utensil on Shabbat. Chutz imeser agadol v'yated shel machresha. Except for certain items which are muksa machmat chisaron kis. These are items that are so important, so expensive that you would not use them for anything besides their primary purpose. Meser agadol is a large saw. It's a very, very large saw that was used maybe possibly by two people, but something that had special teeth in it, it's sharp, whatever the character of this saw is, that people would not utilize it for anything else for fear that it would get damaged. And if it got damaged, then the cost of the damage would far exceed any value you could create by using it for something besides its primary purpose. And the same thing with the Yated Shel Machresha, the pin of the plow, which is the mechanism for the plow, has at the back the knives or the pin that goes into the ground that cuts the furrows. So that Yated Shel Machresha, that's the most important piece of the plow, because that's what does the work in the ground. And that item, again, is very expensive, and you wouldn't want to utilize it for anything else. If damage happened to it, that would be so devastating compared to any value you could create by using this Yated for any other ancillary purpose. So therefore, these items are muksa, we call muksa machmat chisaron kis, because of the loss that would be endured if something went wrong. Those are muksa. You never would even think about using them on Shabbat. And their primary purpose is something that's muksa. So obviously you're not going to use them for their primary purpose on Shabbat. So Rabbi Yossi believes that every other keli is accessible to you on Shabbat. If you need it, assuming that you need it, you can utilize it. So therefore over here, the knife. You pick up the knife. Do you need this knife right now? The primary purpose of the knife is to cut food or to utilize in a meal. But you need it for something else right now. You need this knife to cut open the lock on this cupboard, this rope. Are you allowed to pick it up to do that? Rabbi Yossi says, sure. Why not? You need it on Shabbat. Go ahead and pick it up and cut it open. That's not a problem. Rabbi Lezer savar laki Rabbi Nechemia. Lezer subscribes to the position of Rabbi Nechemia. I haven't seen Rabbi Nechemia for a little bit, but back in the Gemara and Shabbat, remember Rabbi Nechemia had that position that Amar afilu talit, afilu tavad, enin talim, eletzorach tashmishan. Nechemia believes that on Shabbat, a keli can only be used for its primary purpose. So even a talit, even a piece of clothing, even a spoon, which are clearly items that are mutar to use on Shabbat, their primary purpose is something that is allowed on Shabbat. Nevertheless, you can only use them for their primary purpose, for no other purpose whatsoever. And that's Rabbi Nechemia's view in Muksa, that a keli can only be used for its primary designation and nothing else. So over here, you have a knife. You want to use this knife to cut open the rope or cut open the cupboard. No go, because that's not its primary purpose. Its primary purpose is to cut food or to be used in the context of a meal. To use it to cut open a lock is problematic. That's muksa. You can't do that. So that'll be the machloket in our Mishnah here. The Mishnah or the machloket according to the way Abaye and Rava are describing now is a question of can you get the utensil you need to cut open the lock. Can you get to use the knife to cut open the lock? That makes a difference for the Eruv. Is the Eruv accessible to you or not? If you can cut open the rope there, then the Eruv is accessible to you. If you cannot cut open the rope, then the Eruv is not accessible to you and it won't be a good Eruv. Now we have to break it down because this is not so simple. Rashi and Tosafot both mention here that we have a machloket the mission between Tanakam and Rabbi Eliezer according to Bai and Rava. But what is the problem? What exactly is the issue for opening up the lock or this knot here on Shabbat? So Rashi says right away, "De'ihave matzi lemifsuke biyadei shapir dami." If you were able to undo this lock, this rope, with your hands, then it would be fine. Afilu the Rabbi Eliezer. Even Rabbi Eliezer would agree that if you were able to undo this lock by hand, rip open the rope or untie the rope by hand, no problem. De'ein chaticha asura ela b'mechubar. The only time cutting is restricted on Shabbat is when you are harvesting, when you're cutting something that is attached to the ground. Cutting things that are talush, things that are detached from the ground, is not a problem on Shabbat. You cut your food all the time when you're eating. That type of cutting is not problematic. The only types of cutting are when you separate it from the ground and cutting that's exact. Things there where you're carving things into exact shapes, that's also a different problem of chaticha. So over here, you have neither of those. It's not attached to the ground. And in addition to that, Rashi says, Ela makalkelhu. Here you're destroying it. Not only is it not attached to the ground, but you're also doing something that is destructive in nature. Because you're cutting it, you're destroying the locking mechanism, the rope that's there. So both of those combined would tell you that if you could do it by hand, it wouldn't have been a problem. Because you're detaching something by hand, and you are makalkel. So now, the case here is a case of the cupboard, and you have to use the knife, using a utensil. The argument is whether you can use that utensil. It's not about the cutting of the rope itself, or breaking of the lock. Everybody agrees that the breaking of the locking mechanism is not the problem. The only problem is the utensil that you need to get there to break the locking mechanism. For that reason, that's why Rashi says that if Rabbi Eliezer didn't need the knife, then it wouldn't have been a problem. He would agree that you could break open the lock or you can rip open this rope. But then Rashi adds an additional item and he says that even though this migdal is considered to be an ohel, which means that it's mechubar lekarka, and the chazal where goes there, that things that are an ohel, that it's asur lachtoch, that it is asur to cut on them, gzeira, shema, you cut something that's really attached to the ground. You know, ohel with the rope that's tied on the ohel is not really attached to the ground, but the ohel itself is attached to the ground, and since it's connected, there's a gzeira derabanan that you may not cut such a knot, you may not cut such a rope on Shabbat because we are afraid you might then cut something that's mechubar lekarka. So over here he says, well, that's a problem because this is considered to be an ohel. So why are we worried about the knife? We should worry about the knot itself. So Rashi says, well, that's a gzeira derabanan. We're talking about eruv and we're subscribing to the position of Rabbi. Rabbi says, benesh mashot, no problem of dinei derabanan. So, again, in terms of the knot itself, it's either not mechubar lekarka, so we're out of a world of Torah law. It's mekalkel, which is destructive. And then even if it's attached to something that's an ohel, we're only dealing in an issue derabanan. In an issue derabanan, we would have waived it, ben hashmashot. So therefore, the cutting of the knot or the breaking of the lock open is not the problem here. The only problem is getting the knife to do it. And that's what the machloket is in the Mishnah. Tosafot disagrees with Rashi and says that the case here is not a case of a migdal that's an ohel, but rather it's a case of a migdal that's a keli. This migdal is really a utensil, not an ohel, because we're not talking about that problem of Isu Durabanan, because Rabbi Eliezer does not subscribe to Rabbi. One of Tosafot's main rejections of Rashi's interpretation that Rabbi Eliezer subscribes to Rabbi's position is because the only problem of carrying the knife in order to cut open the lock over here is the din of Rabbi Nehemiah. And Rabbi Nehemiah, the din of Muksa. If the only problem is the din of Muksa, which is the din de Rabbonon, then even Rabbi Eliezer should have agreed that in that case, it was permissible to use the Eruv. Because the only thing standing between you and the Eruv is Nisar de Rabbanan, that Isar Muksa of Rabbi Nehemiah. So therefore, Tosafot concludes that it must be that Rabbi Eliezer does not subscribe to that position of Rabbi, and he thinks that even if it's Nisar de Rabbanan ben Hashmashot, that would be problematic like the Rabbanon. Now Rashi could answer that maybe Rabbi Nehemiah's version of Muksa or Muksa is more Chamur, and then even Rabbi would agree there that it is impermissible, although the upcoming Gemara makes it seem like that even if it was just an issue of Muksa, we would waive it ben Hashmashot. So Rabbi is not the issue in our Mishnah, and Rabbi Eliezer believes that ben Hashmashot, it would have been Asur. If there was an Isur de Rabbanan, it would have been Asur. Thing is that there's no Isur de Rabbanan here. Because, again, we're dealing with a keli that's not attached. It's not mechubar de karka. It's cutting that is mekalkel. So there's not even an Isur de Rabbanan involved here. It says there's not even an Isur Darabanan involved here. Rabbi Elezer would have agreed that the breaking of the knot or the opening of the knot is not problematic. The only problem you have is the knife to get it to open. Now, this actually has implications. This Machloket Rashi and Tosafot, pointing it out again, we'll get to it in Beitza. Like we did yesterday, there was a Tosafot that really deals with Shabbat and Beitza, but it has major implications in terms of opening packaging. This as well, this Tosafot as well, has major implications in terms of opening packaging, because Tosafot at the end says, from here, the Ri concludes, that when you have seals on a keli, on a utensil, matir umafkia vichotech, you're allowed to undo them. You are allowed to cut them, break them. I mean, to open up a utensil, you can break whatever is closing it or holding it together. But hainu dafka ke'ein kesho shel mitna. That's only when the seal is like this rope that's tied here. Aval poteach shel etz o shel matechet asur l'shaver. But if the opening mechanism was metallic or wooden, then it would be problematic to break. This is Tosfot l'shitato, like we mentioned yesterday, where he does believe there is binyan and stira in kelim, so he won't let you just break open kelim. Remember yesterday he said that the only reason you were allowed to break the keli in the Gemara and Shabbat and Kuf Mem Vav was because it was a mustaki. It was a glued back together pieces of a old keli, and it was as if it was broken already, or it's a subpar keli. But if it's a real keli, it's a problem of breaking it open. So he says over here, that's true here, if you have a mechanism that opens or you need to access the kli and there's something closing it. If something that's closing it is a real closure, like wooden or metal, we won't let you open that on Shabbat. The only reason you're allowed to open it here is because it's rope. And rope is not a significant closure, because it's not a significant closure. There you can break it open on Shabbat. So you can see already how this has implications in terms of opening on Shabbat. It depends on the nature of the closure. Tosfot says that the more permanent or the more structured the closure is, wood, metal, you cannot open that on Shabbat, because that's stira b'kelim. Tosfot thinks there is stira b'kelim, whereas when you have this rope that's not as strong, it's not a part and parcel of the keli, there you could break it open on Shabbat. So, just noting it again, because that has implications in terms of opening items on Shabbat, like we saw in the Tosafot yesterday. Right, now mafteach is the functional way to get in there, which is a knife. Rope needs a mafteach, it's not a key like we think of a key. The key to getting in is the knife. The next Mishnah, nitgalgel chutz l'tchum, if it rolls out of the tchum, so you put an eruv down, and it was 2,000 amot from where you started Shabbat. But then the wind came, blew it, and now it's more than 2,000 amot away from you. So that's a problem, because you can only place your eruv where you can get to in order for it to be your eruv. If you can't access the eruv, then the eruv's not your eruv. You can't be in one place and have your shvita be somewhere else that you can't get to, you can't reach. So if it's beyond the 2,000 amot, it's not going to be a good eruv. So that's what happened here. It rolled out. You put it down, and then it rolled away. Nafal alav gal, a pile of stones fell on top of it. O nisraf, or it was burnt up. Truma, you put down truma, v'nitmeit, and it became tamei. Mibodjom, if it happens before the sun sets, before shkia, ain't no eruv. Then it's not a good eruv, because the eruv wasn't present or in applicable place when Shabbat started, and therefore you're not kone shvita in that area. Mishech hashecha, if only after dark fell, after tzeto kochavim, harizeh eruv. Then it's a good eruv, because then ben hashmashot, at the entry of Shabbat, the eruv was in place, and after that we say, mashahutra hutra. Once you have the shvita, we don't worry about what happens to the eruv afterwards. The eruv is only necessary at the point of time that you need to do the kinyan shvita, which is in the Benesh Mashor, the Knisata Shabbat. Imsa fake. What happens if he doesn't know? It's no longer there now, but he doesn't know when it wasn't there. He put it down on Erev Shabbat, he comes back on Shabbat, it's not there. When did it leave? When did it disappear? So Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda Omrim, Arizeh, Chamar, Gamal. This person is the equivalent of a donkey and a camel. The reason being that the way that one leads a camel is that they take the reins and they lead the camel. By a donkey, you drive the donkey from behind. Use a prod or some other mechanism to prod the donkey. So if you have an individual who is walking both with a gamal and a chamar, he's walking with a donkey and a camel, so he'll have to be behind the donkey to drive it, but in front of the camel in order to lead it. So he's stuck between the donkey and the camel. So they can basically pull him in both directions. He's getting pulled in both directions because he's trying to lead something and drive something at the same time. He's caught in between. The same thing is true here. He is now in doubt as to where his locus is for Shabbat. Is his Shvitah in his house? Because the Eruv wasn't there when Shabbat came in. And then what becomes the default is where he was Erev Shabbat. Or is his location where he put down the Eruv? Because it still was around when Shabbat came in. And that would make his location or locus for Shabbat, the Shvitah, in the place where the Eruv is. Since he doesn't know, now he's captured by both of them. He has to be Choshesh for both of them. It's the equivalent of the Venn diagrams. Right? The overlap between the two Tchumin is where he'll be allowed on Shabbat. The overlapping 2,000 Amot will be the only location where he's allowed on Shabbat, because then he is definitely okay according to both Eruvim or both Shvitot that he would have possibly done. So don't have to be Choshesh for that. Basically, the 2,000 Amot that are between the two locations, that's the area that he'll be permitted on Shabbat. But to walk to the other side in either location will not be permitted, because then you'd lose one of the Eruvin. And he has to be Choshesh for both of them on Shabbat. That's the opinion of Rameh and Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yishimon Omrim, Safek Eruv Kasher. If you're talking about a Safek Eruv, we'll assume that it's good, and we won't worry about it. I'm Rabbi Yossi. Av Tulumos Heit. Tulumos gave testimony Mishum Chamisha Zekinim in the name of the five elders. Safek Eruv Shu Kasher. That a Safek Eruv is Kasher, similar to what Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Shimon said. So now the Gemara begins with something that we took for granted before, because we assumed this in the questions that we had on Daf Lamed Gimel in Rava's position, which is Nitgalgel Chutz L'Tchum. If it rolls out of the Tchum, Amar Rava Lo Shana Lo Shenitgalgel Chutz L'Arba Amot. That's only if it rolled more than 4 Amot out of the Tchum. Aval L'Toch Dalet Amot. If it's within 4 Amot of the Tchum, Hanotene Ruvo Yesh Lo Dalet Amot. This is what we had asked the question by Rava, by the tree. How come Rav only made the distinction of a tree that's inside the perimeter of the city versus outside the perimeter of the city? Why isn't he saved by any Eruv? Every Eruv grants you 4 Amot. Grants you 4 Amot. It's as if you have a Rishut Yachid under that area. So similarly over here, and this is the origins of Rav's statement, if you have an edge of the Tchum, and for instance, there's a house built. You have 2,000 Amot, and at the end of your 2,000 Amot, there's a house there. The house has 2 Amot inside the Tchum, and then another 100 amot, 1,000 amot outside of the tchum. Since 2 amot of that house are inside the tchum, you are granted access to that house in its entirety. Since the house is the equivalent of 4 amot, and a portion of the house is in the tchum, you can walk that entire house, even though you're extending far beyond the 2,000 amot, because a portion of that house is inside the tchum. So that's what Rava basically says here. If your Eruv is rolled out of the tchum, but it's within 4 amot of the tchum, your Eruv grants you 4 Amot around you. The Shvita grants you the 4 Amot around you. And because of that, that means that the Eruv's 4 Amot overlap into your 2,000 Amot. If they overlap into your 2,000 Amot, you can then walk out to the Eruv. Because just like the house that's on the edge of the Tchum and has 2 Amot inside and 100 out, you can walk the entire house now. And it's not considered like you're going beyond the 2,000 Amot, so to here. If the Eruv is sitting 2 Amot out of the Tchum, that means that for the 4 Amot span around it, 2 Amot are sitting in the Tchum. So for those 2 Amot that are in the Tchum, they allow you to walk the other 2 Amot to get to your Eruv, and then it'll be a good Eruv. Therefore, Rava says, in order for this Eruv to be disqualified, it has to roll more than 4 Amot out. Once it's beyond the 4 Amot, then you no longer have this ability to access it, because there's no overlap between the Eruv and your 2,000 Amot. Now, fellow Avgal, if a pile falls on top of it, Kazaka Datcho, our assumption would be, that if he could, he would get into it. Meaning that he has the possibility of just pulling out the bricks or these stones that fell on it and getting access to his Eruv. What would be the problem with doing that? Well, what fell on it were either bricks or stones, which are muksa. And so since it's muksa, you have an Isur Darabanan separating between you and your Eruv. Lema matznitin deloka rabbi. Let's assume our Mishnah is not like Rabbi. If the only thing that's separating between you and your Eruv is an Isur Darabanan, then Rabbi would say that's waived, ben ashmashot, and it shouldn't be a problem. The fact that the Mishnah doesn't waive it sounds like this is a problem, even ben ashmashot, even with an Isur derabanan. Sounds like our Mishnah is not like Rabbi. Look, Rabbi, Dika Rabbi, if it was Rabbi's position, Amar kol davar shum mishum shivut, and then that's an Isur derabanan, lo gazuela ben ashmashot, then we're not make gozer ben ashmashot. Mar says, no, afilu teima k'Rabbi. Even this mishnah could even fit according to Rabbi. Lo tricha debay moro v'chatzino. To gain access to the eruv with these stones or rocks that fell on top of it, it's not good enough that you just pull away the rocks by hand and it's a problem of mupsa. This is a case where you need a moro, you need a hoe or a spade, v'chatzino and a pickaxe. You need real equipment to get inside of these area or these stones to get your eruv. And those would be problems of iser deoraita. These are tools that would cause you to be in violation of a Torah law on Shabbat. And therefore, that's why you can't utilize this Eruv anymore. The Eruv's not usable because, Benesh Mashot, there was an Isur D'Oraita, a Torah law standing between you and your Eruv. And there even Rabbi agrees, we don't waive the Torah law, Benesh Mashot. That's only when we're talking about an Isur D'Rabbanan. This case here in the Mishnah is a case where we're involved even with an Isur D'Oraita. Vitzricha. Now the Gemara says we need all the cases that are listed in the Mishnah. The Mishnah enumerates a number of cases where you lose your Eruv. One of them is where a pile of stones falls on it. Another one, it got burnt up. Another one is Truma that became Tmeah. So all these, why do you need all these examples? All you have to tell me is if there's a problem with the Eruv, then no Eruv. Why are they giving you all these examples? The Gemara said, Tzrich, we need all of them. Because, Iritana needs Galgel, if you're only talking about the case of rolling out, Mishum the Leta Gabei. Problem is that he and his Eruv are not in the same domain. His 2,000 amot run out before he's able to get access to his Eruv. So that's the problem there. About Nafalo of Gal, but when a pile of stones or an avalanche falls on it, the Ita Gabe, that it's there. It might be that he can't get to it, but it's still within his tchum, so maybe that should be good. Emelavi Eruv. That maybe it should be good Eruv. Itana Nafalo of Gal, had you only told me about the case of the avalanche or where the stones fell on top of it, Mishum de Mikse, because it's covered. It's not accessible to him at this point in time. Aval nitgalgel, if it rolls out of the tchum, zimnin da'ati ziko might delay. Sometimes the wind will come and blow it back. Just like it rolled out, it could roll back in. So that possibility, maybe that should be an Eruv, even though it's out right now, but maybe it'll roll back in, and that's good enough to be his Eruv. But in the case where it's under the pile, and there's no way he's going to get access to it, maybe that's the problem by the avalanche or the pile of stones that fell on it. So, Ema, Lav Eruv, so then maybe this would be a good Eruv Tzricha. So that's why we need these two cases. The case both of rolling out of the Tchum, as well as the case of the stones falling on top of it. Now, Oni Sraf, Truma V'Nitmeit, Lamali. Why do I need these additional examples of a case where it's consumed, it's burnt up, or Truma, and it becomes Tmeah? So, Tana Nisraf. So why did it mention the case of an Eruv that's burnt up? So, Diacha Kocho de Rabbi Yossi. That's to teach you the strength of the position of Rabbi Yossi. Rabbi Yossi in our Mishnah is the second group of Tanaim in the Mishnah. Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Shimon Omrim, Safek Eruv, Kasher. When you have a Safek, it's considered to be Kasher. So over here, even though it's Nisraf, even though the Eruv is completely gone, it's not a question that the Eruv exists. We know it's gone. We know it's completely eliminated. It's only a question of when it got completely eliminated. Nevertheless, Rabbi Yossi says Safek, it's a good Eruv. Then, Tana Truma V'Nitmeit. So Truma, and it became Tmei'ah, L'Odiacha Kochot Rabbi Meir. That comes to teach you the strength of the position of Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir, who is a part of the first pair of Tanaim in the Mishnah, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda, say that a Safek Eruv is Chamar Gamal, or problematic on Shabbat. So Rabbi Meir, in the case of Truma V'Nitmeit, the Truma is still here. The Truma is in front of us. Just a question of when did it become Tmeah? When it comes Tmeah, it disqualifies it because now it can no longer be eaten by anybody. It can't be eaten by him. It can't be eaten by a Kohen. Because Truma Tmeah is restricted from being eaten. So it's no longer Chazi Lei or Chazi for someone else. And that's why it's disqualified. But the object is still here. The Eruv is clearly there and it was clearly in place. Now it's just a question of when it became Tmeah. Nevertheless, Rabbi Meir says that this is not a good Eruv, and that teaches you the power of Rabbi Meir. So he gave you two examples to highlight the opinions of the Tanaim. One highlights the opinion of the one who says it's a good Eruv, that despite the fact that it's no longer existent, it's still a good Eruv. And the other case of Shumam and Itmeit is, even though it's right there in front of us, and it's still in the place where it would have been an Eruv, the only question is when it became Tmeah. Nevertheless, in that case, Tana, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda believe it's still a Safek Eruv, and it's not a good Eruv. Gemara says, V'savar Rabbi Meir, Safek of the Chumrah. From what you're suggesting here, Rabbi Meir believes that whenever you're dealt with a Safek, you go to the Chumrah. That's what he does in our Mishnah. You have a Safek Eruv, he goes to the Chumrah, and he assumes that you have two Shvitot, and only the overlapping areas where you're allowed to walk on Shabbat, V'atanan. Don't we have a Mishnah? Tamei She'arad Litbo. Someone who's Tamei went down to the Mikveh to go to the Mikveh. Safek Taval, Safek Lo Taval. It's a question, did he go into the mikveh or not? Forgot, can't remember what he did. Did he go in or not? Fafilu taval. Or, even if he went into the mikveh, fake taval bar bimsa, sabek lo taval bar bimsa. It's a question whether the mikveh he went into had 40 sa'ah to make it a kosher mikveh, or didn't have 40 sa'ah, so it was not a kosher mikveh. Tosafot brings two opinions about whether this is a continuation, it's a safek sveka, which is that he's not sure if he went to the mikveh, and even if he went to the mikveh, he's not sure if he went to a kosher mikveh, or he brings the alternative reading with the ritva, which seems to be the more simple reading here, that there are two different cases. One case is a safek, did he go enter the mikveh or not? And then he has a second safek where he definitely went into the mikveh. He just doesn't know if the mikveh that he went into was kasher or not kasher. So we have a safek. V'chein shnei mikvot. He has two mikvot there. V'chad yesh bar b'imsa, v'chad ein bar b'imsa. There's two mikvot in front of him. One of them is a kosher mikveh, that's 40 sa'ah. The other one's not kosher mikveh, doesn't have bar b'imsa, but taval b'chad man. And he went into one. He knows he went into one of the mikvot. V'enu deya b'ezimem taval. And he doesn't know which one he went into. Sveko tamei. Then, if he has a sefek in this case, he remains tamei. He is not tahor. B'med v'im amurim. What are we talking about here? We're talking about b'tumah chamura. Talking about when we're talking about serious tumah. About b'tumah kala. When we're talking about lighter forms of tumah, then we don't worry about it. And the Gemara is going to give examples of these lighter forms of tumah, which is kigon. These examples are kigon. Shachal uchlim tmeim. He ate food that was tamei. V'shata mashkim tmeim. Or he drank liquids that were tmeim. He took his body, the robe of his body and his head were inside of Maim Shuvim, drawn water. Or he got a 3 lug worth of water, Shuvim, that were poured over him. And now he goes in to go to the mikveh. Safek taval, safek lo taval. And now we're uncertain as to whether he went in the mikveh. All the uncertainties that we saw before. All the cases enumerated here in the Mishnah of Tumah Kala are Tumot Dirabanan. These are part of the Yud Chet Devar. These are part of the 18 items that were Nigzar in the first parak in Shabbat. They were Nigzar for reasons. Here we have the Ochlim Tamim, the liquids that are Tamei, are problems with Truma. We're afraid that he's going to eat it together with Truma. Problems of the Maim Shuvim are a problem that they were thinking when they went to the mikveh that the water was Maim Shuchim. You can imagine here in Israel that over the summertime, if you only have rain during the rainy season, and the only water that's going to be in the mikveh is water from the rainy season. By the time you get through part of the summer, the water that's in there is pretty putrid. And therefore, people were going to the mikveh. And then when they came out of the mikveh, they were taking a shower. Because the water was disgusting. And then they started to think, they were afraid that people were going to think, what's really making you tahor? It's not the mikveh, it's the shower afterwards, which cleans you off. So they didn't want people to come to that conclusion. And so they're precluded. People who have mayim shuvim, drawn water poured on them, or they go into drawn water, then they become tamei. Then they lose that benefit of the mikveh. They did that to prevent people from going to the mikveh and then showering immediately afterwards, to separate between the two, so people didn't think that it was the bathing afterwards that was causing the tahara. These are all gezeirot derabanan, tumah derabanan. So over here, in this tumah derabanan, we have now the Mishnah saying that what we said in the first half of the Mishnah, that when you have a safek about whether you got into the mikveh or not, then you are tamei. That's only dealing with tumah chamura. Now we know the definition of tumah chamura means tumah deoraita. But by tumah derabanan, tumah kala, that is not the case because safek, in that case where he has a safek taval, safek lo taval, safek whether he got into a mikveh or not, vafilu taval, or if we know for certain he went into the mikveh, safek taval bar bimsa, safek lo taval bar bimsana, and he has a question as to whether the mikveh he went into had 40 sa or didn't have 40 sa, v'chein shnei mikvot, or two mikvot, v'chad yesh ba 40 sa, v'chad ein ba 40 sa, one of them has 40 sa, one of them does not have 40 sa, v'taval achad mehem, and he knows he went into one of them, v'enu de bezmehem taval, he doesn't know which one he went into, sfeko tahor. Here we have a safek tahor, Rabbi Yossi mitamei. And Rabbi Yossi is mitamei. So what we're focused on here is this sfeiko tahor. The assumption being Stam Mishnah Rabbi Meir is also the Baal Plukta of Rabbi Yossi, so it's likely that it's Rabbi Meir's opinion here. So Rabbi Meir says in a case where you're faced with a safek dirabanan, we go the kula. If a safek in tuma dirabanan, we say the person is tahor, the kula. So now what about our Mishnah? Our Mishnah is a case of safek dirabanan. We're dealing with tchumin. Tchumin is an isur dirabanan, safek dirabanan, and yet Rabbi Meir is going to Chumra, and he's saying that it's a problem. Why would in one case you go to Chumra, and in one case you go to Kula? My answer is, Kasava Rabbi Meir, Tchumim de'oraita ninu. Rabbi Meir is of the opinion that Tchumim are actually min ha-Torah. And if they're min haTorah, the safek in our Mishnah is akin to the safek of Tumah Chamura. Case of safek doraita, we're going to go the Chumrah. So our Mishnah is a safek doraita for Rabbi Meir, and therefore he goes the Chumrah. The case here with the Tumah in Mikvaot, that's a case of safek derabanan, we're going to go the Kula and say he is Tahor. So that's what they're saying now. Rabbi Meir subscribes to Rabbi Akiva's position. Very good. So Gemara is going to come back and ask exactly right. The Gemara only asks on Rabbi Meir, but it's clear here you have Rabbi Yossi with a problem as well. Because Rabbi Yossi here is saying, Tamei in a Safek Rabbanan, and yet in our Mishnah he's saying, fine, that David was good in a Safek Rabbanan. So the Gemara will come back and address Rabbi Yossi later on. Right now it's focused on Rabbi Meir's position. Vesava Rabbi Meir Tchumim Doraita. Is Rabbi Meir really believed Tchumim Ar Doraita? Vahatnan. We have a Mishnah. Im En Yochol Lahav Lio Bezu. If he's unable to incorporated in this manner, Amar Rabbi Dustai Bar Yonai Mishum Rabbi Meir Shemati Shemikadrin Beharim. I heard that they drill holes through the mountains. So the case here, it's something that we're going to bump into later in the Masechta, is how do you measure Tchum? So the Mishnah gives there the way or the instructions for how to measure the Tchum. You take a rope that is 50 amot long, and then you measure 50 amot swaths at a time. So you have one guy holding one end of the rope, a guy holding the other end of the rope, 50 amot long, and you measure the 50 amot until you get out to 2,000 amot. What happens all the way at the end of the tchum, the end of the 2,000 amot, all of a sudden you have this big ditch that's there. Now, if you were to measure the ditch going down the decline and then up the incline on the other side, your 2,000 amot would end somewhere in the middle of the ditch. If you traverse the ditch, meaning that you only look at the surface area of the ditch, then everything would have been incorporated inside of the tchum. That's what that Mishnah is speaking about. It says, if he's able to incorporate it by taking, meaning that the from end to end or edge to edge is less than 50 amot, then you have a guy stand on one side of the ditch, a guy stand on the other side of the ditch with this rope that's 50 amot, and he considers if that's only 50 amot towards the eruv. And the eruv would incorporate the whole ditch, even though the surface area of that is greater than 50 amot, but because the span across the top is less than 50 amot, it is included in the tchum as is, meaning that it's a stretch of 50 amot, and we don't worry about the decline and incline from there. On the other hand, if it's wider than that, and for whatever reason it would end in the middle, 2,000 amot would either end in the middle of it, or you can't get the 50 amot rope across it, then it's not included as a span. Then you have to actually measure the decline and incline. You have to measure the actual surface space of this ditch, or the surface space of this mountain. How do you go about doing that? So there are two ways to do it. You could do it with the same 50 amma rope. If you do it with the same 50 amma rope, maybe what you're going to end up with is the hypotenuse of this ditch, or the hypotenuse of the mountain. Because you're taking a 50 amma rope, it's going to be a long rope, and you're going to measure along that hypotenuse, the line, the surface area climbing up. On the other hand, the other option, and this is what the Mishnah suggests over here, is they can use a much shorter rope. And they use a shorter rope, they use an arba amot, they use a rope that's only 4 amot long, and then they take 2 people. The person that's higher up on the mountain, will say, puts the rope at his foot level. The person who is lower down on the mountain puts the rope at his chest level. And then they measure that step by step. So instead of measuring it as the hypotenuse, again, let's take a case where you have a incline and a mountain that's 50 amot long. If you were to measure it with the rope, the 50 amot rope, you would basically end up with 50 amot as being the surface area of that mountain because you're measuring the hypotenuse. If you use a 4 amot rope and measure it in a step-like function, you can have the rope here, he puts it at his feet, the other guy's chest, then you go up another 4 amot and you do that. You keep doing it. Basically what you're doing is you're having step, 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 step. You're basically measuring the base of the mountain by doing that. Instead of measuring the hypotenuse, you're measuring the base of the mountain on a right triangle. Instead of measuring the hypotenuse, now you're measuring the base of that right triangle to get the surface area, because you're measuring on a step function basis.
You're basically measuring the span of the ditch.
Right, but you would lose some because you're doing it 4 amot, 4 amot. You might get a drop longer than the base, but in practical measures, it's somewhat akin to the base, because you're using this short rope. So maybe it's a drop more, but you're right. In the end, you're basically measuring the span instead of the surface area. You're measuring what is the span if you kept it absolutely flat, and that's what he says in the Mishnah. The Mishnah is, we drill a hole straight through the mountain. That's exactly what you're doing here. You're measuring it as if there was a hole, a tunnel through the mountain, and you're measuring it in that way. By doing it in this manner, that's exactly what you are measuring. So now, Rabbi Meir is the one who says it here. It says, Amar Rabbi Dustai Bar Yonai Mishum Rabbi Meir. Now this is a kula inside of Tchumim. V'isa kadatcha Tchumim Doraita. If you think that Tchumim is really a Torah law, Mi mikadrin. Would we allow you to take up this kula? Would we allow you to take the measurement of the base rather than the hypotenuse? And would we allow you to use the direct line of span rather than the surface area of the mountain? We wouldn't let you do that if this was a din d'oraita. V'amar Rav Nachman amar Rav Avua, ein mikadrin. We don't allow this methodology. Lo barei miklat, v'lo be'egla arufa. When it comes to two other Torah laws, we do not allow that dispensation. Mipnei shehen shel Torah, because they are Torah laws. Egla arufa, you have to measure from the cadaver that's found. You have to measure to the closest city. So how do you measure to the closest city? Over there, we don't allow this mikadrin b'bahar. We don't allow this ability to measure the flat area. We tell you you have to go up, down, and do it basically the surface area. And that's how you measure the distance to the nearest city. Because we're machmir, because it's a Torah law. By arei miklat. Arei miklat function as an ir miklat, not only in the city itself, but in the tchum of the city, the area that's around the city. And so you have to measure what that tchum is. That tchum is measured, again, in this much more stringent manner. You have to measure this surface area, whether it goes up, down, no matter how it goes. We don't flatten it out. We don't assume that it's flat. So here you have measuring that's done in Torah law, and we don't allow this dispensation. So if Rabbi Meir really believed that a Reuven is a din, a Torah law, then he shouldn't have allowed the Mikadrin. How come he's allowing this dispensation? Mar says, Lokasha, ha didei, ha dirabe. The difference between his opinion and his Rebbe's opinion. Dekanami, that makes a lot of sense. Diktani bezu, amar Rabbi Dostai, Rabbi Yana, mishum Rabbi Meir. Shamati. Rabbi Dostai, Rabbi Yana says the name of Rabbi Meir, and this is what Rabbi Meir says. Shamati, I heard. Well, Shamati indicates that he heard this from his Rebbe. He got this as part of the Misorah. Not that necessarily he believes that, but that's what the Misorah, that we got from his Rebbe. Shemikadrin Baharin. That you're allowed to use this Kedira Baharin. So the difference being in the opinions is in our Mishnah, it's Rabbi Meir himself. Rabbi Meir himself believes Tchumim D'oraita, and therefore he's Machmir in our Mishnah. In the case of the Mishnah later on in the Masechta that's talking about how you measure the Tchum, over there, he's quoting his Rebbe. His Rebbe believes Tchumim are derabanan, but Rabbi Meir himself doesn't necessarily subscribe to that position. Shema mina. As to who Rabbi Meir's Rebbe is that says Tchumim are derabanan is a little difficult, because Rabbi Meir's Rebbe is Rabbi Akiva. And Rabbi Akiva is of the position that Tchumim are doraita, and that's likely where Rabbi Meir got that position. So which Rebbe is it of his that is saying, or that he's quoting, that says Tchumim derabanan? And that most likely has to do with the Gemara that we saw earlier in the Masechta, where we saw Rabbi Meir learned both by Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yishmael. And therefore he did have Rabbi Yishmael as his Rebbe for a period of time. And that might be who he is quoting when he says Tchumim derabanan. He might be quoting that memra from Rabbi Yishmael. So Mar says, Virami deoraita adeoraita. Okay, you resolved the problem here. All of Rabbi Meir's opinions we've cleaned up. We have three opinions of Rabbi Meir, and we've been able to reconcile all of them. We have a Meir in our Mishnah. That's deoraita, therefore he's Lukumra. We have Rabbi Meir in the Mishnah Mikvot. There is the Kula, because that's a din derabanan. We have Rabbi Meir later on in our Masechta, who is the Kula. That's his Rebbe. He's quoting his Rebbe. It's not Rabbi Meir himself. But maybe we have another problem, because we have another memra of Rabbi Meir, which is, let us now ask from two different Torah laws, the Rabbi Meir, that's not. Nagach be'achad balayla. He was adjacent to someone at night, and he touched him. Ve'niyodeim chayim meit. And he didn't know when he touched him if he was still alive, or if he already passed away. He gets up in the morning, matza'o meit. And the person next to him has passed away. Rabbi Meir mitaher, ve'chachamim mitamim. The mayor says the person is tahor. The chachamim say he is tamei. Shekol atmeot kishat mitziatan. Chachamim believe that anything that's ma'ah is determined by the time that you find it. When he woke up in the morning, that's his first realization that he has tumah here. At that realization, it's tamei. Then we assume that that's what the din is. He's tamei because he found the mate. He knows he touched this person at night. And his first knowledge of the person next to him about their status is when he wakes up in the morning and they're dead. So when he found them, they're dead, they're tamei. We assume that at night when he touched them, they're tamei. That's the position of the chachamim. Rabbi Meir says to Hor, you have a safek here. You don't know when you touched him if he had passed away or not. And therefore it's a safek. We go safek le kula. Here we're dealing with a dindoraita. We're dealing with tuma tamei. Tuma tamei is a Torah law. And yet, what do you see? Rabbi Meir is the kula. So now we have Rabbi Meir by tchumin saying that if it's a Torah law, then we go to chumra. Over here by tumata meit, we have Rabbi Meir saying a case of safek, we go to kula, even though we're dealing with a Torah law. Amma Rabbi Yirmiya Mishnatenu. Our Mishnah here, the one in Erevin, is kishaya alaiha sheretz kol ben hashmashot. There was a sheretz on the eruv, the entire ben hashmashot. So since the sheretz there on the entire ben hashmashot, there is no more safek. Because it's clear that the Truma is Tmeya. If the Truma is Tmeya, that's why Rabbi Meir says over here that the Safek ends up going to Chumra, because there's no question here that there was no Eruv. So Gemara asks the obvious question. Yachi, Ba'alim Rabbi Yossi, Safek Eruv Kasher? Please, then what's the other side of the equation? You made it so good that Rabbi Meir says that it's not an Eruv here because it's so clear there's a problem. If it's so clear there's a problem, then you've just eliminated the possibility of someone arguing on him. Why would Rabbi Yossi in that case ever say that the Eruv is a Safek Kasher? There's no Safek anymore. There was a Sheretz on an all Benesh Mashot. It was clearly Tamei all Benesh Mashot. It's not a functional Eruv. It was Trumat Tmeya, the entire Benesh Mashot. So then we can't understand Rabbi Yossi's position. So that certainly cannot be the answer to our question. Ela Rabba v'Rab Yosef Damrei Tavayu, Hacha b'shtei kitei edim askinan. We're dealing here with two opposing witnesses, groups of witnesses. Achat omerit, you have one group of witnesses coming and saying, that the Eruv became Tmeya during the daytime, before the onset of Shabbat. Achat omerit, and the other set of witnesses says, kishecha shecha, that when dark fell, it only became Tmeya after dark fell. So now, these two sets of witnesses are contradictory, but their difference in opinion will determine whether the Eruv is a good Eruv or not. Alright, so now we have two sets of Edim, and they're offsetting. You have offsetting sets of Edim, and now what do we do? So normally we would say, Hemed Davar al Chezkato, which means, leave the item in its original state, the Chazaka. Chazaka means, what was the last time we knew about this item? What was its status? So with regards to the person in the bed, the last time we knew them, they were alive. And since they were alive, the assumption is that until we find them dead or passed away, they were alive. Because that's how we found them. So until we have evidence to the contrary, we assume they're alive. And that's why Rabbi Meir, in the case of the person in the bed, says, Tahor, you found them passed away in the morning, let's assume that that happened when you woke up. Until that point, they were alive. Over here, too, your assumption would have been, Chazaka, that you placed the Eruv there. The Eruv was in location last you knew about it, unless you had placed it down, there was an Eruv there. So the Chazaka is that the Eruv is good. In that case, Rabbi Meir should have said again, Safek Eruv is Megula, and it should be a good Eruv. Here you have something that undermines the chazaka. You have two sets of edim that are contradictory, so they in themselves have no impact. Because these two sets of edim are offsetting, and now we're back to the original safek. But the one thing they do is that they undermine the chazaka. Because now you have a set of edim saying that it wasn't there, Benesh Mashot. You've now lost that chazaka. Even though you have other edim who say that it was, nevertheless, you've now created a safek in what you otherwise assumed would have been the status quo. Status quo was the item there. Now you've opened up a safek, even with regards to whether the status quo was true. And because of that, you lose the chazaka. And that's why Rabbi Meir over here says, safek l'chumra, because the chazaka is no longer in place. So in a place where you have a chazaka, in a place where the status or the status quo remained until you found otherwise, there, Rabbi Meir goes, l'kula. In a case where you've now lost that assumption of status quo, there he's going to go to the Chumra. So that explains by Tumat Tameid, he goes to Kula, because the status quo was the person was alive, that was the Chazaka. Finds him dead, we assume that that happened now, not before. And if that's the case, he is Tahor. In the case of the Eruv, had it just been about the status quo, you're right, it would have been the Kula. The problem is now we have two sets of Edim arguing about whether the status quo really is true. And so therefore you've undermined the Chazaka, and undermining the Chazaka, you no longer have that status quo to rely on to say the Safek is the Kula. Rava Amar, Rava suggests that the answer to this stira in Rabbi Meir is, Hatam Trei Chazke Lekula, V'chacha Chada Chazaka Lekula. Over there you have two things Lekula, over here we only have one Lekula. And that is because by Naga Bechad, when you came into in contact with the individual itself, you have two Chazakot. Because one is that the person next to you has a status of being alive. That's the Chazaka. The last you knew of them, they were alive. The chazaka is that people stay alive. That's the general chazaka, that people stay alive. We don't assume that they pass away. Unless they're on their deathbed and their death throes, then we assume maybe they'll pass away. But otherwise, we assume that a chazaka, a person's alive. That's one chazaka. The second chazaka is the individual himself. Has a chazka tara. He has a chazaka that he is tahor. He was pure, and therefore he has a chazaka to remain in that status quo. So in the case of the Tumat Tameit, you're dealing with two status quos. One status quo is the person themselves has a chazka tara, they're assumed to be tahor, and you're dealing with another chazaka, which is the chazaka of the mate, the person who passed away, that they were alive. So if I take those two chazakot and put them together, I go, the kula. I assume that that's the kula, because I have two chazakot in my favor, so that goes safek the kula. Hocha, in the case here, by the Mishnah, by our Eruvin, you only have one chazaka. Because you can say, Hemed Truma al Chazkata. The only chazaka you have is that the Truma was not Tmeya ben Hashmashot. The chazaka was that the Truma was Tehora, and that's the chazaka that you have. Other than that, there is no other chazaka here. So there we go, the Chumrah. When you have one chazaka that's supporting, one status quo that supports your position, Rabbi Meir says, go the Chumrah. That's our Mishnah. Our Mishnah is a case of one chazaka, Truma, Tehora. Now it's Tmeya. So that's only one chazaka. There, we can't give you the benefit of the doubt. On the other hand, if you're dealing with multiple chazakot, in a case where you have two things indicating that you should remain in the status quo, there we will give you the benefit of the doubt. And that's the case by Tumata Meit. The case here, when you entered the bed together with this individual, there were two things that are true. You were Tahor, that's one chazaka. Number two is the other person was alive. That's another chazaka. So when you have those two chazakot, we're going to give you the benefit of the doubt that the chazaka or the status quo stays in place. And that's why in the safek, in that case, you remain Tahor. So that's how Rava explains that difference. Now we have the question that you raised, which is, Kasha, the Rabbi Yossi, the Rabbi Yossi. What are we going to do with Rabbi Yossi over here? Okay, we're going to stop here.